Hello and welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. Tonight's guest is very well-esteemed colleague, airline pilot and medical doctor. So he has a great career behind him already. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks, Jonathan. My name is Niall Downey. As you say, I've got a dual background. I started off, I trained as a doctor in Trinity College in Dublin. I got my fellowship of the Royal College of Surgeons and was specialising in cardiothoracic surgery. I was working in between Belfast and Dublin. That was back in 1999 at that stage when the new specialist registrar training system was bedding in, and unfortunately there wasn't enough jobs to go around and a few of us got caught between the stools. Now, I'd already tried America, Australia, the UK and so on for long-term training jobs, and unfortunately there just wasn't any available. There was loads of work, but no long-term training jobs leading to a consultant's post. So I got caught, as I say, between the stools. The following week, I saw an advertisement in one of the Irish Sunday papers for cadet training pilots for Aer Lingus. So I applied for that. There's 4,500 of us applied, and I get in number 11 of 38. So since 1999, I've been an airline pilot. I'm now a captain on the Boeing 757 Atlantic fleet. So I'm over and back to the States every few days. And for quite a few years, I combined healthcare and aviation by doing casualty shifts. I was doing casualty SHO and registrar shifts just to keep my hand in for about 7 or 8 years. And then I ran out of time doing that after having a young family, as you might know yourself.
Absolutely.
back in 2011 then, I combined the two in a slightly different way. I've set up a business called Framework Health Limited, which takes our aviation safety model and has translated it to healthcare. They try and take the best of what we've learned in aviation over the last 40 years regarding safety management and error management and applying it to my old field of healthcare.
Very good, Niall. I mean, fascinating background. I've got this vision in my head of if we ever go for a pint together and I introduce myself as a pharmacist and then you come up and introduce yourself as a doctor, and that's impressive enough, you know, and then something else comes up. Oh, and I'm a pilot as well, you know. I'd never get a look in, Niall.
You'd be looking for me to buy all the rounds.
Exactly. So where are you phoning in from tonight?
I'm actually in Hartford, Connecticut at the minute now. Obviously, we tried to do this last week from home in Northern Ireland, and I live in a field in the middle of nowhere, so our rural broadband didn't quite pass muster. So we're having another go here now, today, and I'm in a Marriott hotel in Hartford, and it seems to be connecting a lot better. So
very good. But if it was a field in Northern Ireland, what a field it would have been. Right, let's start. So I'm really interested in this whole area, and I'm a bit of a closet aviation geek as well. For example, I know the stall speed of a Cessna 128 is about 60 knots. You know, so I apologize if the inner geek comes out in me. I think your whole reason for being around the risk agenda is very relevant in healthcare, and I'm going to drag it towards pharmacy if that's okay. So, and in aviation, from conversations we've had before, you've explained that, like, aviation is just, the ethos is just totally different. What, in a nutshell, is different in how you manage risk to what you, or how you see risk being managed in pharmacy or healthcare?
Well, in a nutshell, the difference is that we see error as inevitable. We don't see any shame in it. We expect to make mistakes. So we're quite happy to put our hand up, admit we made the mistake, and try and deal with it. That's it in a nutshell.
Very good. And, like, if I pull you into community pharmacy, right, so it's basically, I know you're a doctor, so you'll have been heavily trained in, you know, managing dynamic risk that emerges and fades away and so on and so forth. But in community pharmacy, it's quite a procedural task, although there are professional judgments to be made. Or what piece of advice would you give someone who's running a community pharmacy tonight to make it safer?
To make it safer, acknowledge to themselves and make very clear to their staff that it's okay to make mistakes. So once you've established that, that's the starting point. We need to change the underlying philosophy. In healthcare at the minute, perfection is what's expected, and that's just not possible. And if you expect perfection and refuse to accept anything less, that means then you get a lot of issues getting sort of covered up. People won't acknowledge them because they know they won't be sort of forgiven for them, if you like. So the biggest thing is acknowledge to yourself that you're going to make mistakes today, that you're going to make mistakes every day, and teach your staff that you expect them to make mistakes, but you expect them to speak up and acknowledge them and tell you about them, but that there will be no, if it's a genuine mistake and not gross negligence or deliberate harm, obviously, if it's a genuine mistake, that it will be dealt with appropriately, and there'll be no repercussions or no penalties applied. I mean, that's the basic philosophy behind what we do in aviation.
Like, what's your view of healthcare in general? And also, have you got a view on pharmacy or community pharmacy, how safe it is? Or,
well, healthcare generally, there's a huge issue. Everyone's known for decades that there's a huge issue, but still nobody's addressing it. When I started looking into this about 8-9 years ago, I found figures and I assumed I'd misread them. So I started cross-referencing them from different directions, and whatever way I cut them, the numbers all stacked up, and the numbers are just absolutely staggering. In healthcare generally, any admission to a hospital, the figures internationally, worldwide, show that 10% of patients admitted to the hospital suffer some form of error. And the figures show that anywhere between 3 and 10% of them, it's such a big issue that it either causes or contributes to their death. Now, if you apply that, there's figures published about 2 years ago now. The BMJ published them in 2016. It was a study by Professor Marty McCarty from Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore over here in the States. They published a study looking at the number of deaths due to human error in the American health service. Now, they only looked at the hospital system. They didn't look at primary care, and they didn't look at the nursing home system. So he opens basically by saying this is an underestimate. But if you take those figures and apply them to the UK sort of figures, assuming we're no better or no worse, he reckons there's about 1,000 deaths per week in the UK health service due to human error.
Cheaper, huh?
Now, personally, I think that's mind-blowing. And there's been a bit of quality improvement work done over the last few years, but I don't really think any of it's addressing like the main underlying problem, which is that human error is ubiquitous and has to be treated as such.
So do you know, is that human error or is that all sorts of errors?
Well, that'd be all sorts of errors, but system errors are basically because the humans who designed the system didn't really look ahead and think, well, how can this be sort of done wrong? How can this go wrong? So all types of error eventually really come back to human error. So our philosophy in healthcare is, or in aviation, sorry, is that if a mistake happens, even if it's something quite small, we would report it to their safety office. And obviously, again, you have to take human factors into account. If it's time consuming or difficult for me to report it, I'm not going to bother. So ours is made extremely easy. We've all got an iPad at work. So say if I'm flying, I have an iPad parked beside me. During the cruise, when it's quiet, I can write out a quick report. I go into our safety net system. It's mostly drop-down menus, so I can do it sort of quickly tap out what the summary is. I can type in a text box, just a very quick summary of what the issue was. And then as soon as I get on the ground or on a 330, we've got Wi-Fi, I can just hit send and it goes straight to their safety office. And the other big issue is that we get feedback from that. That in healthcare, I know a lot of friends that put reports in, which can maybe take them half an hour, 40 minutes, which you don't have. And then they never hear tell of them again. We get a feedback report every month, giving the summary of the most important issues which occurred in the airline that month.
Okay. And is that the only way you get feedback? Do you share feedback as a group or?
Well, we put it in, obviously so we talk amongst ourselves as well, but there's 600 pilots. I don't meet most of them. There's a lot of pilots in the company I've never met, so that's not really going to work. So that's why we have our safety net systems. We actually have an air safety office, which reports directly to the chief executive with nobody in between. It's taken that seriously. And the pilot in charge of the air safety office is basically like at the same, similar sort of management level as the chief executive. It's given so much weight. So we send a report in to the staff. There's, I think, about 5 or 6 staff work there. And they receive about 20 reports per day. And we're quite a small airline. So usually they're sort of small, insignificant stuff. But our logic in aviation is that all these wee small, insignificant things can sort of snowball together until they eventually become something very big and very significant. So we try and deal with them as we go along. So we would send a report in. We can telephone it in. We can send it in a paper form. or most people now, we send it electronically by iPad because that's the environment we live in now. So we can send it in very quickly and very easily. If there's any information needed beyond that, they can get back in touch with us and sort of ask us to clarify things and follow it up a bit more. And then every month, there's a report published looking at all the biggest things or the major incidents that happened in the airline that month. Again, most of them are very small and very insignificant in themselves, but our worry is that they can snowball together to form bigger things. Now, some of them are things that we observe. They're not our fault. We didn't actually cause them, like, say, an air traffic control incident, but we were sort of involved in the periphery or we were dragged into it. So we would report that on, and then our safety office can then liaise with, say, air traffic control in London or Madrid or wherever it was, and try and find out what the issue was. And then we then have a look and see, well, why did that go wrong? What happened in our system? And we then sort of usually find that there's a tripwire in the system somewhere that hadn't been thought of before. So we then redesign the system and take out the tripwire and replace it with a safety net. And then finally, our sort of whole sort of philosophy is around the crew resource management type ethos, where we assume we're going to make mistakes. And everything we do, all our standard operating procedures are based around trying to deal with that issue.
So it's back to like assuming that stuff's going to go wrong sooner or later, and you're not denying that fact or the fact that any team member would ever not make an error.
Well, as I say, we take it, error as being inevitable. It's no matter how hard you work, you're not going to bring it to zero. So when you make an error, we don't see any shame in that. And in healthcare, they apply the name, blame, shame, retrain model. In aviation, we apply what's called the just culture model, that if we make a mistake, as long as I put my hand up and acknowledge it and then deal with participate in the follow-up as to what happened and how can we resolve this, as long as I do that, there's absolutely no retribution to me, no disciplinary action. And that's actually enshrined in international law in aviation, that as long as we cooperate. And again, as I say, it's not a get out of jail free card. It doesn't cover gross negligence and it doesn't cover deliberate harm. But if you make a genuine error, you're covered by international law, that you can't be disciplined.
You see, in community pharmacy, you know, there's a big debate about the decriminalisation of dispensing errors. But the fact that, in my opinion, that they were ever a criminal offence was absolutely daft, because it just flies in the face of the evidence that you're quoting and the experience of the aviation industry that is obviously quite far in advance of what we're doing, you know?
Yeah, well, even the community pharmacy, obviously one of the biggest cases in the last few years was a Northern Ireland case, we both know of ourselves, the Martin White case back in 2014.
Yeah, very sad.
Again, lots of human factors issues going on. He reached up to lift prednisolone off the shelf, lifted an almost identical box, parked right beside it, which turned out to be propranolol, and gave it to a 67-year-old lady who had an exacerbation of COPD. And unfortunately, she took, instead of taking six tablets of a loading dose of prednisolone, she took six tablets of propranolol, and obviously her blood pressure crashed, and unfortunately the lady died. Martin White ended up getting, I think it was 2 years in jail for manslaughter. Now, in aviation, like that would provoke a walkout. That just contravenes everything that we stand for and contravenes like international law as we see it. Like in that sort of case, without going into too many details, it seems to have been a genuine error. It certainly wasn't deliberate. In a genuine error case like that, in aviation, we would look and go, well, why did he make that mistake? And when you look at the human factors aspect, there was multiple reasons why Martin White made that mistake. Now, we would then start trying to address that, change packaging, change where stuff is stored, things like that, rather than sort of vilify the pharmacist who did it. And I think that's the biggest thing we need to change in healthcare. Now, again, we need to bring the staff along, but we also need to bring the patients along with us. Patients need to understand that error will happen. When they interact with any healthcare professional, it's not going to be perfect. Mistakes will happen. And they have to accept that a genuine mistake may happen, and not immediately resort to legal action and looking for compensation. And in fairness to patients, all the studies that have been done in this area show that when something goes wrong, what a patient wants is an apology, an explanation, and some evidence to show that something's been done about it to stop it happening the next patient coming along. All the evidence shows that patients don't want to go to court, and patients aren't looking for compensation. So I think if we can try and sort of educate patients along with the staff to accept that error is acceptable and error is normal and not something to be ashamed of. I think then we can start making progress. And in community pharmacy, again, you're interacting directly with the patient, and that would be an ideal chance to try and sort of show you, yes, mistakes will happen. And the other thing as well is that we've, in our crew resource management model in aviation, we basically think that everyone involved has an input. So like the most junior cabin crew member is expected to come to me if they have any concerns or anything that they're worried about. And I will take it on board. Now, it might turn out that they're wrong, but their input will be made more than welcome. I will have a look and see what the problem was and then incorporate that into our whole safety management system.
Yeah.
In healthcare, patients need to take responsibility as well, that when we give them a drug, they need to have a look in the box and see, is this what I was expecting to get? Themselves and their families need to start joining in. The healthcare is not a spectator sport anymore. We would see them as a vital part of the crew, the same way as we see our cabin crew, air traffic controllers, and even passengers as part of the crew. If a passenger sees ice on the wing, we expect them to report it to the cabin crew, who will bring it to me. Same thing in healthcare. Patients and their families need to get involved in their management as well. If they see something they're not happy with, they can't just go, oh, well, he's the pharmacist or he's the doctor, I'm sure he knows what he's doing. They need to get involved and say, I'm not sure about this. Is this correct? Is this a mistake?
Yeah, well, there's a number of case studies I'm going to chat to you about in a minute. I know you're very familiar with them. The Martin, I mean, I don't know Martin personally at all. I mean, I've just read what everybody else has read in the press, and a bit of me is loath to drag up the topic again, but we have to talk about it and understand it. And I'm just thinking
they're bought for the grace of God, go I.
And me, Niall, and me. And I've made dispensing errors too, you know. Most pharmacists do actually, but I think the community pharmacist listening, their mind's eye will go to that part of the shelf, you know, propranolol, prednisolone, such a potentially dangerous combination, the non-specific beta blocker in asthmatics, and beside the prednisolone, which is the common treatment for an exacerbation. You know, if you thought it out, you really wouldn't put them beside each other. And actually, I'm thinking of a certain brand, or a certain, you know, there is a generic company that make prednisolone and propranolol, and some of the strengths, they're not exactly the same colors, but they do look, you know, pattern wise they're similar. The other interesting thing you said was about hierarchy. Now, I haven't come across that in community pharmacy. You know, it's my way or the highway. But I do know that some, and I can't quote any, but there have been some sort of notable examples in aviation where basically the captain has spoken down to the first mate or whatever, you know, the second in command, first officer, and enforced an order. Isn't that right? And that's led to disaster.
Well, I think you're probably talking about the Tenerife disaster back in 1977.
Yes.
It's still the biggest aviation disaster in history, and hopefully won't be exceeded. That's where our aviation safety model really stemmed from. And back then, during the 70s generally, there'd been quite a few accidents, and it was gradually increasing in numbers and in severity. And after Tenerife, I think the industry sort of realised, no, we can't keep doing this, or people are going to stop flying airplanes. So that's when they actually sort of stopped and looked and said, right, what's going on here? What can we do with this? And they sat down with NASA and various other bodies and had looked to see how we could change it. It started off initially as a concept called cockpit resource management, where they tried to change how pilots interacted with each other. And very quickly they realized, no, it's a much bigger agenda than that. And they widened it right out to crew resource management, where it now involves everybody. But from the hierarchy point of view, what you're talking about, what happened that day was about 8 or 9 different layers of human factors issues, all of which contributed to the accident. If we'd managed to intercept any of those layers at all, it's James Reason's Swiss cheese model, that it's only when all the holes in the cheese line up that the accident gets through and happens. But the hierarchy part of that was the KLM Jumbo that was taken off on the runway. The captain involved was the chief pilot, and had been involved in KLM's advertising strategy for the previous year. So apparently his face was on about a quarter of the billboards across Holland. So he had a very high profile, and probably a very high ego. And the first officer with him was a very junior guy. So when they were lined up on the runway, again, there was loads of different layers, but the hierarchy part was that he thought he was cleared for takeoff. The co-pilot thought that he wasn't and spoke up, but the captain said, no, we're clear for takeoff, and overruled him. And the co-pilot just said, right, okay, knowing that he was heading down the runway towards another jumbo jet. Nowadays, I would like to think that just doesn't happen anymore. If a co-pilot speaks up about something as big as that, like our initial reaction is stop, right, okay, I don't know exactly what's going on here, but let's just stop and think about this and talk about this. Our hierarchy now has changed from a steep gradient to a very shallow gradient. Now, I think that's what scares a lot of the consultants I've tried to explain this to. They're very slow to give up their authority, and they don't want to like lose their decision-making power and delegate their authority to a junior staff member. That's not what happens. That's not what we do in aviation. I'm the captain. The buck still stops with me. I still make the call. But we have a very shallow authority gradient now. So if someone tries to feed information to me, I stop and I take it on board. And I think long and hard before I would overrule it. That's what I try to get in the hospital system particularly, or in the community pharmacy setting. You're not giving away any authority at all. You're still the boss. You're still in charge. You're just taking input from more people.
Well, sir, you make excellent points. I mean, the point about hierarchy, you know, where there's hierarchy, there's control, isn't there? So these, I guess if we apply it to, and I must declare I've never worked in under a consultant physician, but I assume there is a lot of hierarchy there, potentially bullying and that type of stuff going on, control and all that sort of stuff. So it could often be, unless they have great foresight and are quite open-minded and confident in their role, they might well shut it down for junior members of staff, and that could be risky. I don't have any evidence of that, though. I don't know if there is medical evidence of that.
Well, there's quite a lot of research into bullying in the health service, and I don't think anyone denies that there is quite a bit of bullying, so there's no real sort of shocker there. Obviously, I think it has improved compared to when I was there 20 years ago, that people have come through now. I think the millennial generation, I think, don't tolerate bullying the way maybe that my generation would have accepted it and taken it as normal. But there certainly is still bullying there. And that's one of the sort of cultural issues that needs to be addressed, that senior people need to be able to sort of stand back and take input from more junior people.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really interesting. I was in Tenerife. I'm glad I was in Tenerife before I spoke to you, Niall, and went through that case study, to be quite honest. But we were there in the summertime on holiday, and I'm not sure, but I think there was not a near miss. I would be unfair to say, but we were coming in to land on final at the Tenerife South. Beautiful night, great visibility, no exacerbating factors that I could see. And suddenly the plane, you know, he had full flaps down, I assume 5 or 10 miles out, and flaps came back in, wheels came up, and off we went, and up and round we went. And when we landed, he said that the pilots declared that we had got too close to the plane in front. We'd come within a 2 mile buffer or a mile and a half?
Well, it depends on the airport. In Heathrow, we can be 2.5 miles apart.
Okay.
And then obviously it depends on the size of the plane, because you're trying to avoid wake turbulence. Like if you imagine a speedboat in front of you, when they're plowing along the water, they churn the water up quite a bit. So it's the same with air. If we've got a jumbo jet ahead of us, they churn up quite a bit of air. So we need to be a certain distance behind so we don't get buffeted about.
Okay. So how serious an incident would that be in your world?
That's a non-event. It was dealt with. Somewhere to Heathrow is a good example. They pack them in very, very tight. If we're following another plane of a similar size to us, we're generally about 2.5 miles apart. So that means, as well as the wake turbulence issue, when the plane ahead touches down, that gives them time to slow down, turn off the runway, clear the runway, just as we're about to land. So Heathrow are absolutely superb at that. They can pack us in very, very tight. And because we're in and out of Heathrow so regularly, and we know how good they are, like, we will sort of extend them a bit more leeway than we might say somewhere down another country down Europe somewhere. We let it go to 2.5 miles. If we get any closer than that, if we're not happy or if air traffic control aren't happy, it's called a go-around. It's just we've thrown full power and we climb away, and it's an absolute non-event. So we wouldn't even consider that an incident. If we continued on and went on ahead and landed and pretended it didn't happen, that's an incident. The fact that they realised, right, no, we have a cut-off point. Once we get so closer than, say, 2.5 miles, that's too close. We're not happy anymore. On the way in, they've already discussed, if anything changes, if we're not happy, we're going to go around. Now, every runway and every type of approach, we actually do a brief on the way in, saying, that here's how we're going to line up on the runway. Here's the height we're going to start our top of descent at. Here's like the inbound course we're going to take. Here's like the approach lights we're expecting to see when we get closer and so on. If it all goes wrong, we're going to go around. Here's how we're going to go around. So we, in aviation, we would have actually already discussed that scenario on the way in.
That's fascinating.
Probably in the cruise. So it became such an on-event a few years ago that Aer Lingus actually said, no, tell you what, lads, no, we're trying to encourage you. They actually wanted to encourage go-arounds so that people wouldn't sort of push the boundaries too much. And they said, we're changing the regulations. If you go around in the future for something like that or not being stable enough, they said, we don't even want you to report it. So it's not only is it not an incident, we don't even want to hear about it. Now, I think they've changed it slightly now since, because with social media, people put on, if they went around, again, people like yourself who don't understand like how small an event or a non-event that it actually is, they were putting things on social media and then the company weren't sure what it was about. So now we report it just to give the company the heads up that we went around in a certain scenario. So if there's any social media feedback, they can sort of react to it and deal with it. But something like that, again, like that's part of our safety management system. If we get closer than a certain distance, we're going to go around. We're going to climb to a certain height. Here's where the mountains are, so we know how to avoid them. And then somewhere like Heathrow, you just sort of come back around again. You get slotted back into the traffic flow, and 10 minutes later, you land in. So it's an absolute non-event.
Yeah, so you're always ahead of the game. You're always planning. You're always thinking what's going to happen and stuff.
Well, the idea is like we accept error. Now, error doesn't necessarily mean that somebody got something wrong. Like, error means like something didn't work out the way we hoped. So like we assume error. So as I say, like in the cruise, before we'd even start descending into Tenerife, we'd have gone through, so here's the type of approach we're going to make. If it all goes wrong, here's how we're going to get out of jail. So say if we come down, say we're landing, and as we're coming into land, somebody accidentally taxis out onto the runway for takeoff. Obviously, we can't land now. The runway's blocked. So we've already discussed, Grant, we're going to put on full power. We're going to bring the flaps up. We're going to bring the wheels up once we're climbing. We're going to level off at this height, and we're going to come back around again. So we've already discussed that issue. We assume that something is going to go wrong, and we've already got our plan B all discussed out. It's already programmed into the computers on the airplane, so that as soon as we hit the go-around sort of buttons, if you like, the plane will automatically kick into, oh, right, we're going around now, so here's where we're going to go. We've already that all programmed in. So the whole basis of what I try to teach the health service from my framework health angle is basically, where can this go wrong? What's plan B? I mean, that summarizes the entire aviation philosophy in two lines.
Very good. I must declare, I find myself becoming more and more Northern Irish, and I'm speaking quicker and quicker and quicker the longer I speak to you, Niall. So I hope everybody's keeping up at home.
Interrupting you.
You're just taking me back to my base, you know. No, it's really good stuff. Quite a different mindset, I think. There's quite a bit of, like, going to community pharmacy, so there's quite a bit of work that does happen around near misses with the simple dispensing errors. So, standard practice, as far as I know, would be there's supposed to be a no blame culture. You know, it's okay to report and write down your errors. If an error goes out of the shop, then you would certainly report it centrally electronically. And then there's the normal sort of feedback in the moment, if at all possible. You're looking for the different types of errors, people factors, you know, place factors, all some of the things that you've mentioned already. I do know as well that there's some compilation of near misses. So I think the National Pharmacy Association have a central error reporting service on a website, which I think is quite useful. But a new, to move away from community, so a new cohort of pharmacists is these people like me who are non-medical prescribers. Now, you're a doctor, so you've sort of been brought up with prescribing and, you know, managing a condition and you know, working out if folk are well or not, and how you decide, you know, building a diagnosis and then taking forward their management and managing the risk as it emerges. What's your advice for me as a, or as, or another pharmacist who is a new non-medical prescriber and starting to manage patients?
God, that's a broad one. Well, again, come back to what I've been sort of saying all along. The first thing I would start with is expect to make mistakes. So say when you do prescribe something, stand back then before you hand over the prescription and go, right, does that make sense? Is that actually what I intended to do? Like your brain can sort of drift off. Like, I'm going to write down prednisolone, and you actually write down propranolol. Check before you hand it over. Again, where can this go wrong? What's plan B? So where can this go wrong? Have I actually written out a prescription for what I had in my mind? Or did my mind wander? Did I get distracted? Have I put down the correct dose? Or have I made a mistake? Assume that you're going to make mistakes, and like, always double check and triple check things. Again, in aviation, we're big into our checklists. People seem to think checklists are an instruction manual of how to fly an airplane. They're not. We still need to know how to do it, but we use checklists as our sort of final sort of safety net before we do something stupid. So it's there to protect us. Maybe even have some sort of checklist in place that before you hand over a prescription, stop and have a look at it. One of the biggest things is check, have you got the right patient?
Yeah.
And then when I was sort of teaching students in the ward, how to read an x-ray, they can carry the thoracic surgery. Obviously, we were taking a huge amount of chest x-rays. So I would put the chest x-ray up and ask, right, talk to me about that chest x-ray. And what I expected, first of all, was them to go and say, right, this is a chest x-ray of Jonathan Laird. It was taken on the 24th of January, 2019. Right, so we've established before we go on, there's no point in telling me that there's a tumour in the left lung until you tell me whose lung are we looking at here. So again, back to simple things like that. Before you hand over the prescription, have I definitely got the right patient? I know in Northern Ireland, it's probably the same as Scotland, lots of people are named after their parents. So before you hand over the prescription to John Smith, are you sure it's this John Smith and not his father? Again, a lot of prescribing is done electronically now. So the two of them are probably on your system, and it's very easy to click on the wrong one. So make sure you've got the right patient, make sure it's the right address, the right date of birth, make sure it is actually the drug that you planned to hand over, have a look at the dose, and then maybe even stop to think before the final check, is this likely to interact with anything else that this patient is on, or is there any other sort of comorbidities that this would sort of contraindicate for? So I would start with things like that. Basically, assume that you're going to make mistakes and constantly have some sort of safety net in place before you actually hand over the prescription. Now, it sounds as if that's very time-consuming. It's not in aviation. Like, we do that just a second nature. So we do these things very quickly. And again, even checklists. The checklist I used last night to get me from Dublin to Connecticut here, it's one A4 sheet to cover the entire flight between all the different stages before we push back off stand until we parked in Connecticut. The whole thing fits on one A4 sheet. So it's not big, it's not time consuming, but it's extremely valuable. So if you have something similar in your mind, even in prescriptions, just have a wee checklist that you run through.
Yeah, yeah, just the basics. Checklists are interesting. I suppose the pharmacy equivalent might be standard operating procedures. And I'm thinking of, there have been some quite interesting learnings from certain aviation cases, I think, you know, where pilots have basically forgot to fly the plane. You know, they're not looking out the window, they're looking at their instruments, and they've just forgot, they're going by the checklist, and they're, you know, following, in pharmacy terms, following the SOP. I'm thinking, was it not the Air France incident where they had a high speed stall, and the pilot, that might have been a hierarchy issue as well. The pilot forgot to basically dip, you know, dive. He didn't realize that he was stalling at high speed, as far as I understand. Do you recall that case?
Yeah, that was the 2009 Air France 447 incident. Again, like all of our incidents, there was a whole layer of things that happened. There was like multiple levels of issues. Again, it wasn't as straightforward as that. And even it turned out that Airbus's stall recovery technique worked in most scenarios, but didn't actually work in that scenario. So following that, we were actually training a new stall recovery technique in the simulator within weeks of that happening. even though we didn't find the black boxes for 2 years. But something like that, we would sort of break down what happened from that and try and work out all the different layers of how can we address this, how can we do this differently. Again, in that case, it wasn't really a hierarchy thing so much. The captain was actually on his break. There's two co-pilots involved. But one of the big reasons we report things as well is that that was a perfect example. Now, obviously, in aviation, big things like that, you can't hide things like that. In healthcare, it's easier to hide mistakes. But we report things because when they looked into that Air France incident, they discovered that one of the issues is that for the previous 10 years or so, they'd been encouraging us pilots to use the automatics as much as possible. So use the autopilots and use auto thrust, because that then freed up capacity for us to focus on what was actually happening, which was great. But it meant then we got out of the habit of actually flying the airplane. So they realized then that when the thing actually went out of control, the pilots hadn't enough actual hands-on experience to try and recover what was going on. So since that now, internationally, we're now building into our training programs every 6 months, how to handle basically adverse sort of incidents in the plane where you get the plane out of control, and discovered that we had lost the basic sort of flying skills. So every 6 months now, we're actually going through a module globally, all the different airlines in the world, on how to recover from an incident like the Air France incident. And in that case, at the start, for the first minute or two, the airplane was totally recoverable. So our idea now is that we use our reporting system. They say, well, where are the problems? Like internationally, where are the problems? Where are things going wrong? And how do we address that? So again, where can this go wrong? Our reporting system shows, like say, the Air France incident showed that pilots had forgotten how to fly airplanes. What's plan B? Well, let's train them again, how to fly airplanes. So we now get, we'd have to say, close our eyes in the simulator, and the instructor will put the airplane into like a crazy position, like 40 degrees nose up and like a 45 degree bank. And then say, right, open your eyes, and you have to look at it. Right, now recover the airplane. So we're now being trained in how to do that. And again, we're big into our systems. We're being taught, you know, there's like a three-stage procedure that we apply, like 1, 2, 3, and we apply it one after another, and it will recover the scenario for us. So again, if we could get the same idea into pharmacy or into healthcare generally, find out where the issues are, and then try and train that up for everybody. Because if you've made the mistake, chances are I'm going to make the same mistake tomorrow. So how about you make the mistake and you tell everybody, and we try and work out a plan to avoid it, and then mm-hmm. hopefully I don't make the mistake tomorrow. I mean, that's the sort of concept that we have in aviation that I'm trying to introduce in healthcare.
It's great advice, Niall. It's really interesting speaking to you. You've great insight, and I think your you know, your concept that you're speaking about is highly relevant to healthcare. Now, I think I will get into trouble if I don't give a plug to a certain person and a certain organisation. You're doing a very important talk in a few weeks. Do you want to mention that?
Well, so there's a couple coming up. I presume you mean the Pharmacist Defence Association. Mm-hmm. They have a number of conferences coming up at the minute. There's one in Belfast at the end of February. So I'm speaking at that. So basically trying to get across the sort of concept we've been speaking about for the last while. There's a national one then coming up in Birmingham on the 30th of March. So I'm also speaking at that, hopefully to a broader audience to try and take it national. And I think there's possibly another one coming up then in May in Wales. So hopefully some of your listeners will be able to actually sort of see in the flesh what I'm trying to do and see the presentation of how we actually do it. Obviously, I do sort of a slide presentation. Now, most sort of medical conference slides are an awful lot of words cut and pasted onto the slides. I don't really believe in that concept. Mine are all mainly photographs and very short video clips that will provoke sort of thought of the kind of things we've been covering for the last sort of few minutes. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it's like some of your listeners will be able to get along to one of those three talks and hopefully interact as well and tell me where they think I'm talking rubbish and how we can do things.
Because I certainly don't think you're talking rubbish, Niall, and I think I'm coming along to hear it, and I mean, I could talk to you all night about it, but I don't want to because I want folk to come along and hear you in person.
Well, hopefully the idea is that I try and encourage as much interaction as possible, and people are going to disagree with what I say. I mean, a lot of people don't buy the concept of what I'm trying to teach at all. which is why there's been such slow progress. I set the business up 8 years ago, and I'm still struggling to get people to buy the whole concept. So people obviously do disagree with what I'm trying to teach and what I'm saying. So like, hopefully on the day, I would like them to put their hand up in the audience and say what they think is wrong and say where they disagree. And we can try and work out then, are we misunderstanding each other? Have I got something wrong? Have you got something wrong? And work out between us. Because again, this is a team sport. I don't see this as I'm going to come along and teach you how to do your job. You know how to do your job. I don't know enough about your job to be able to dictate to you anyway. My idea is that, no, here's something that we've learned in aviation, which I think is extremely relevant. And between the two of us, I think we can engineer this in. So about 10 years ago, the health service tried to engineer in crew resource management. And the way I describe it is it was transplanted. That they took aviation sort of safety type approach and just dumped it on the health service. Said, right, there you go, eat that. And it doesn't work like that. The two industries are very different, and you can't just take our aviation safety model and dump it in healthcare. But the way I put it across is I see it as genetic engineering, that the underlying DNA and the underlying issues are extremely similar. And I think that I can sort of bring my system along and we can modify it and tweak it and engineer it into your environment and make it work in the community pharmacy and the healthcare sort of scenario more widely.
Absolutely.
So that's what I would hope that people on the day would speak up.
The one thing we have in common is that we're all humans, aren't they? There's always going to be a human in the system at one point or another. So I think your point about why, you know, there hasn't been a mass uptake of your concept, maybe they don't want to hear the truth, you know, maybe they don't feel comfortable with admitting that. By they, I mean, I don't know, senior leaders or people in positions of authority. Well, don't see a problem, you know, and that's worrying.
Well, part of the problem is, I mean, if I was a pharmacist, if I read the Martin White case, I wouldn't be in a hurry to put my hand up. I mean, it needs to come from the top that we need to accept that error is inevitable, and that error, again, isn't something to be ashamed of. It's something that needs to be managed and dealt with. I mean, my whole concept with Framework Health is error management, that we expect it to happen, but we need to be able to deal with it. So from your point of view, you'd be very slowly putting your hand up if you're going to be taken to court and charged with manslaughter and maybe end up going to jail. So we need to change the whole culture from the top to the bottom, that error is accepted. And obviously we're not going to be able to change that until senior management and hopefully right up as far as ministerial level get involved in this. Now, I think there is some buy-in at ministerial level for the last few years, but it needs to trickle down to hospital management, that they accept that if their staff do make a mistake, you can't just get straight in there and punish them for it, that it has to be accepted as normality. Again, they're human beings. Human beings make mistakes. Human error is inevitable, which is why error management is, I think, such a critical issue, that if it doesn't get managed, it'll go underground, which is the way it is at the minute, and then it never gets addressed. And then the next guy comes along and makes the exact same mistake, which is why I think we've made no progress for the last 30 or 40 years.
Absolutely. Now, listen, thanks very much for speaking to me now. Absolutely fascinating going through some of those cases. Not at all. It's been great. So I'll see you. March the 30th and 31st, I believe, is the PDA conference. So I know we've spoken quite a few times over the years. So I'll finally get to meet you in person, which will be great as well.
That's super. Look forward to it.
All the best, Niall.
Thanks, Jonathan. See you then.
Cheers.